you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 184 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyra, your host once again. And today my guest is Elizabeth Hill. Elizabeth is a Texas attorney, a winery owner, and as if she doesn't have enough challenges, a mother of four children. She's an avid entrepreneur and she owns her own law practice, solo practice, and at the same time, along with her husband, founded and owns the Berkeley Hill Vineyards based in Lubbock, Texas. So her law practice deals primarily with commercial litigation, but also includes a robust and substantial wine and vineyard law practice. So we're going to learn about what the issues are for those practicing in the niche area of, say, winery law, or to some extent, distillery or maybe craft beer law, because there's some similarities there. And we're going to find out how she juggles all these balls up in the air while being a mom of four. And when at the same time, she's pretty well known throughout the state of Texas as an advocate and a lecturer on women's empowerment. And so we're going to spend a few minutes talking to her about that as well. So I'm delighted to have as my guest today, Elizabeth Hill. Elizabeth Hill, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Hi, Neil. Thank you for having me here. I'm excited.
I'm super delighted to have you join us today, Elizabeth. And do you go by your full name, Elizabeth?
I do. I've in the past had a few people call me Liz, but predominantly Elizabeth, yes.
My mother would definitely approve of using the full proper name, you know, being from London as she was. So anyway, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Well, of course, I'm an attorney. I'm also co-owner with my husband in another business called Berkeley Hill Vineyards, which is a winery and vineyard, which is a lot of fun and a lot of work. And then also a lot of fun and work, I have four kids. And so
that's full time right there.
I stay pretty busy, but really enjoy all of it.
Terrific. And you were attorney first and a vineyard owner later, or the other way around?
Well, it kind of all happened about the same time. Okay. I met my husband right whenever I was going to law school. And so we got married while I was in law school, which was really fun. We didn't really even have a honeymoon. But so he had been growing wine grapes before we met. He's been growing since 2002. And so then we together started making wine about 4 years ago.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, now you're in Texas, right?
Yes, Lubbock, Texas.
Lubbock. You don't normally think of Lubbock, Texas as the wine center.
Well, so we're trying really hard to change that perception. So about 80 to 85% of all wine grapes in Texas are grown in this area. It's got a really nice dry climate, which wine grapes need. It's hot during the day and cool at night. So wine grapes really thrive here. And so I think a lot of people in Texas are starting to hear about it, but we're still working to spread the word outside of Texas as well.
I did a little horseback riding in Arizona not too long ago, which is a state that a large part of my family is located from. And I was shocked to find that there were vineyards in Arizona for the same reason, the dry, arid climate.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of counterintuitive. Cotton is a big crop here in the Lubbock area, and cotton actually takes more water than wine grapes do. And you think you see these big, lush vines with juicy grapes, and that's just kind of hard to believe.
Indeed. So tell us a little bit then about your practice. Well, let's go back to law school. When you came out of law school, did you go to work for a firm? Were you a solo right from the get-go? What has been your journey in the practice of law?
Well, I started out at a firm. I was actually kind of a non-traditional student. I went back to law school in my early 30s, and I think that was actually a really good decision. I think I did really well as a non-traditional student, meaning that I probably did better at that stage of life than I would have if I'd gone straight from undergrad. And so at the time, I went to what is considered a larger firm here in Lubbock, which only had about 18 attorneys, so that's not big compared to the big cities. But it was a larger firm for Lubbock, and I really enjoyed it. I had a great experience. I got to do some really neat things. I enjoy appellate law, and I actually was able to do quite a few appeals at that larger firm. And then I decided, you know, kind of being later in life, getting into the law, I was impatient in my career, and I really wanted to get to a point where I was just working my own cases and managing my time and my workload. And so about 2.5 years ago, I opened my own practice.
Well, our journeys are similar. I think I got you beat, though, in one respect. I was much older when I went to law school. So as an alternative student, I get that. You bring a different set of experiences. And in my humble opinion, a different approach to going to law school than some of the other younger students. Not to say that all of them, you know, took a decidedly different approach, but I felt like the older students were different. And in my case, I treated going to school like a job. You know, I went, yes. I got up, I went to law school 8 o'clock in the morning, whether I had a class or not. And I stayed until 6 o'clock, whether or not I had classes or not. And I worked all through that day on kind of a work kind of schedule and then had some family time. And then, you know, did my reading at night, and I treated it like a full-time, you know, employment.
I did the exact same thing. I actually had 3 young children at the time that I went to law school. And so I had to treat it like a job. I just, you know, and luckily my law school, Texas Tech University, was so helpful to parents like me going to law school. They made sure I could go to a class starting at 9 a.m. so that I could get the kids to school before that, and then treated the day like a job, and then spent time with the kids or activities after that, and then did some reading, you know, right before bed. And it worked pretty well. I obviously had to do some additional work on the weekends or gearing up for finals, but it was a good experience for me.
Well, I just, you know, as challenging as it is, I really don't understand how you can do it with 3 small children. Mine were a little older, but that's real Herculean kind of stuff.
Well, thank you. You know, I luckily I was not the only one. There were some other parents, and so we all kind of commiserated together about how challenging it was to balance everything. But luckily, as I mentioned, I'd met my husband. We got married during law school. He was a great support and partner.
As if you didn't have enough to do during law school, you'd do a wedding as well.
Yeah, well, I timed it really badly. I thought that I was going to hit it just right. And somehow we scheduled it the Friday before Monday midterm. And so it was really not good. But it was good in the respect that we became a family and all of that was wonderful. But yeah, the timing was not well played out.
That's crazy. So how long did you spend in big law then?
I was there about 5 years before I went out on my own.
And the entrepreneurial spirit that drove you to open your own practice, had you been kind of cultivating that view and that thought throughout law school and your time at the firm? Or is it something that hit you over the head, said, hey, all of a sudden, I think I'm tired of this, I'm going to do it on my own?
It was really something that kind of hit me over the head. I had never thought throughout law school and my first couple of years of practice, I never thought that I would go out on my own. But the more that I worked in a big firm, which there are things about it that I really enjoyed, the more I became hungry to kind of be my own pilot or driver of my career. And that's kind of what gave me the bug. And I did meet and get to know a few other solos in the community. And that really helped a lot to see how they were doing it and get some advice and just eventually decided to do it.
Law school didn't teach you the business of law. I know how hard you work. As you practice law, manage your firm, rainmake, making sure the bills are paid, you wear so many hats. You feel like you're stuck in neutral all the while, working more and more hours. Fortune 500 CEOs all have coaches. Why don't you? You've got to talk to my friends at lawcoaching.com. Lawcoaching.com has coached solo and small firm and medium-sized firms like yours to huge growths. Head coach Anthony Garacci coached his firm to 490% growth over 5 years. And he can do it for you. Are you tired of trying to find great associates to do your work? Do you want more freedom to grow your firm? You got to talk with Anthony Garacci and Law Coaching at 855-455-0050. It's 855-455-0050. You deserve to invest in yourself and take your firm to exceptional results. Visit them online at lawcoaching.com or call them now at 855-455-0050. Well, tell us a little bit about that. What was your thought process? How did you go about the implementing the start of your firm? And did you start, say, on the kitchen table, or did you jump right in and get some retail space, or how did that manifest itself?
Well, I think I was really lucky, and I think this is something I would recommend for those thinking about branching off. I found a couple of other solo attorneys that had an extra office. And the good thing about these attorneys is I'd already been getting referrals from them.
Oh, great.
And so, yeah, so we already had kind of a working relationship. And I just, contacted them. I knew they had a little bit of extra space and asked if it might be possible that they might want to lease it to me. And so it was really a good, seamless way to transition. And I continue to get referrals and we refer back and forth. And so it's a really good situation. And I do think that that helps with being out on your own to at least have a couple of attorneys that you can go to or walk down the hall. And even though you're both in solo practice, you can bounce ideas and thoughts off of each other.
Sure. Now, was there a particular practice area that you were focusing in on? And has that remained the same, or were you open to ideas?
Well, I've always preferred and leaned towards commercial litigation and business law. And I did practice some of that at the big firm, but I also had to do a lot of other stuff that while I enjoyed any type of litigation, I had to do quite a bit of insurance defense. And that did not end up being my favorite area to practice in, although it's much needed, of course. And so when I branched out on my own, I then kind of left insurance defense behind and just went into commercial litigation. And I do appellate law. And of course, I'm developing my wine law practice as this area continues to grow with wineries and vineyards.
And that's what I wanted to get to, because one of the professed secrets of making it as a solo is to adhere to the adage that the riches are in the niches, and that if you can niche your practice down to a unique area, you stand a far better chance of success than if, say, you're a general practitioner. Now, I personally feel that there's a lot of truth to that, but it isn't the only way to be successful. Nevertheless, I would venture to say that practicing wine law, for lack of a better term, or the law surrounding the business of wineries, is probably a fairly narrow market and one that you can dominate in.
Yes, and it's narrow in Texas as a whole. There are a few firms in the Austin and Dallas areas that specialize in it, but I'm the only attorney that I know of that specializes in this area of Texas. And it is so specific and so regulatory that you really do have to kind of immerse yourself in it if you're going to understand it and learn it. And speaking more to what you mentioned about practicing in kind of a general practice, I just find that it takes so much more time whenever you're doing something that you don't do every day. And so I think it's just, not only does it help you thrive in your solo practice, I think it helps you just perfect that specialization and saves you time, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, it certainly is more efficient because you don't have to keep, you know, looking up the law every time you get a different case that you haven't dealt with. You know, I have to think back now, I had forgotten this till you started to mention it. We had somebody who did craft brewery law here in Maryland. I'll have to go back for our listeners and figure out who that was and include a link in our show notes. But I was surprised at what different areas tend to be addressed by those who are practicing law in the wine industry or the distillery industry or the craft beer industry. So what are some of the legal issues that industry faces and that, you know, that you are providing services in?
Yeah, well, it is really interesting. Even just between breweries and wineries, there are such different laws that apply, and it's all kind of over the course of history split differently. And wine, to some degree, has been pretty lucky when it comes to the law. Wine has gotten some privileges that some of the other distilleries and breweries don't have. And I've been watching because I think that eventually they'll get them because there's no real legal justification for it. But it's, as I mentioned, it's very regulatory. Anytime you're going to actually open a winery as opposed to maybe just a retail shop or something like that, it's a very long process getting approved by both the federal government or the TTB, the Tax and Trade Bureau, and your local state ABC, which is an alcohol beverage commission. So here in Texas, it's the TABC. And that whole process usually takes at least 4 months and can take longer depending on the backlog and the wait and if you have any unique issues or just what's going on at that time. And so that's primarily where I practice in helping wineries get permitted. And it's tedious, it's labor intensive, time to just complete lots of documents and get lots of information from your client. And then helping them, guiding them as far as what they can and can't do is often complicated. And sometimes it's not perfectly spelled out in the law. So it's the other thing is that it's always changing. You were mentioning breweries. The breweries in Texas, their law just completely changed in September, where you can now take beer away from the brewery and you couldn't before then. And so it's really interesting. It's changing on a regular basis. And so you have to keep up to date as well.
So the permitting process, is it simply kind of a paperwork type of transaction, or are there specific issues that the wineries have to overcome in order to obtain permits?
Well, it is a lot of paperwork. There are some issues that they have to be careful of. For example, in the United States, most states adhere to the three-tier system, which that would be for an entire different podcast. But I think the three-tier system will eventually go away. And what the three-tier system is this regulation that most of the states have implemented that you cannot be in all more than one of the three tiers. So the three tiers are manufacturers, which are wineries, breweries, distilleries, distributors, which are companies nationally. Some of the big ones are Republic and Glazier's, or a retailer, which of course would be a restaurant or your liquor store or a grocery store. And so if the owners have any type of tie or ownership or connection to any of the other two tiers, they cannot get their application to go through. And it's a really interesting ordeal. It ties back to prohibition and mm-hmm. the desire for there not to be essentially a monopoly that the mob bosses had back then. Sure. So it's a really antiquated system, in my opinion. And I think we have other laws that address monopolies well. And so it's just really interesting. So there have been a few people that say, well, I have a restaurant, but I want to open a brewery. And there are a few different, there's something called a brew pub. There's a few ways to get around it, but it's really complicated when you have any ownership in any of the other tiers.
Now, here in Maryland, where I live, we have some wineries just literally up the street and around the corner. And both of them have kind of the same model where they grow and manufacture the product on site there. But they also then have a lot of social gatherings to bring people to the winery, tastings, events, and what have you. You can purchase wine and leave the winery with that wine in hand. And you can also become a member of that winery and have a variety or a selection sent to you. I would think that all those hurdles have their own legal issues. It's interesting that both the wineries around here have overcome all of that and are able to do so. Is that the same kind of experience that you have there in Texas?
Yes. So about right now, and it's really kind of flooded in the past several years, but about 45 out of 50 states now have pretty open regulations with wineries, allowing wineries to sell plenty of wine on location. They can ship direct to the consumer, and we can even ship to other states that allow it. As I mentioned, there's still a handful that don't. And that is something that is a bit more unique to the winery industry. Okay. I think breweries and distilleries are trying to catch up with that. But for example, right now, I'm working on our own ship to direct permits in other states. We can ship right now to Texas and New Mexico. And then we can get into other states that allow it. As I mentioned, there are a few that don't. But wineries have I don't know if they slipped through the cracks or have just always been treated differently throughout the years because wine is special and all those things. Sure. It's considered, you know, it's got biblical roots. But wineries have really had some good legal privileges that the rest of the alcohol industry hasn't always had. And so that's been something that's come up in litigation recently. And I don't blame them. I think they should pursue those issues. But so the winery that you're speaking of, it sounds like Maryland has similar laws to Texas where we can consumers can buy on location, you can ship to them, you can join the wine club and have it shipped or picked up. And so it's really, in my opinion, a good system for the most part for wineries.
And tell me a little bit what makes the practice of, for again, lack of a better term, wine law, winery law, what makes that a challenge? Are there some specific types of cases that are unique that present a unique challenge, or is it simply attracting clients that you can serve or getting your name known as the provider of these legal services in terms of integrating it with your law practice? What are some of the challenges that you face?
Well, that has been somewhat of a challenge. I think I'm a bit fortunate because I am in the wine industry personally as well. So I get to know people and they know that I'm an attorney and they hear from their buddy that I did their wine permit. And so it's starting to grow that way. But really, for solo practitioners, they would have to kind of get in the industry, so to speak, at least going to conferences, maybe getting to know the growers and the wineries. And that's the neat thing about this industry right now is there's starting to be a great deal of overlap, whereas in the past, most of the growers or farmers just kind of stuck to growing. And now they're actually opening their own wineries and doing both. And so getting to know the industry, I think, would be important. As far as the challenge of actually practicing, it's just very, sometimes it's tedious. And, you know, with anything involving the government, sometimes it depends on who you who you draw as a reviewer of your permit application. And it seems like every time I submit a label, which labels have to be approved by both the TTB and your local TABC or ABC. And it seems like every time I submit a label, I hear about some other obscure requirement that the last reviewer didn't catch. And it's tough to memorize all of those, but it's things like, well, this font on this particular line on the front label needs to be slightly larger in comparison to the AVA designation. And so it's just really complicated stuff like that. And the good thing about that kind of stuff is you just correct it and send it back to them the next day and it'll get approved. But it's just kind of tedious to learn all those details, and they're also ever changing. So that's a challenge as well.
You started your law practice to ditch the firm life and be your own boss, but your practice is running you. The good news, being an attorney entrepreneur doesn't have to be this hard. Jesse and Megan, the lawpreneurs behind Jurisdiction, are working to build a new generation of solo practitioners who love being lawyers. This year, Jurisdiction is introducing a new program, Next Level Law Practice. Next Level Law Practice is a rigorous training program that provides the tools and business fundamentals for estate planning attorneys to start and grow a profitable and streamlined legal business. Next Level Law Practice gives you access to videos, worksheets, templates, one-on-one coaching, and live group sessions that allow you to ask questions and learn on your own schedule. To learn more about the program, visit thrivejd.com. That's thrivejd.com. They're even offering an exclusive coupon code for the Law Entrepreneur listeners. Just enter the code TLE150, that's like the Law Entrepreneur 150, for a $150 discount off your course registration. And welcome to the show, Jurisdiction. Support for today's episode comes from Ruby Receptionists, dedicated to helping you grow your practice one happy caller at a time. From their offices in Portland, Oregon, Ruby's live remote receptionists create an exceptional experience for your callers by answering calls live with your custom greeting, delighting callers in English or Spanish, transferring calls, taking messages, collecting new client intake, and much more. Just like an in-house receptionist at a fraction of the cost. For 15 years, Ruby has been turning rings into relationships. For more information, call 844-895-7829 or visit callruby.com/lawentrepreneur. Yeah, in terms of branding yourself as the wine lawyer, I suppose there's conferences and gatherings that you go to. And I was just thinking as you were talking, given the choice of going to a legal conference or a wine conference, I think a wine conference has to be a whole lot more fun than a legal conference.
Oh, it is so much fun. And there's always lots of wine. And yeah. The neat thing about the industry, especially in Texas, is it's competitive, but it's very much still a community. And so everybody brings their own wine and we taste each other's and enjoy each other's company. And so, yeah, if you're getting into wine law, I would recommend going to the wine law conferences, seeing if you could even get on the schedule as a speaker, which I've done several times. And that has also gotten me some clients there as well.
Now, I also know that and you've alluded to it earlier, that you're very active in your community. And so you're very visible, not just as an entrepreneur developing a winery and as a law office owner, a practice owner, but you're also active in women's empowerment efforts there in Texas. Tell us a little bit about that activity and how that relates to your practice.
Sure. Well, I just really enjoy myself. I enjoy being around other women that are aspiring entrepreneurs or own their own businesses or executives. And I have a few groups that I attend that are just that. And it's for the purpose of supporting each other, for kind of being a community that we could go to for questions and also referrals. And so I've done a lot of work for people within those and referrals for people that have been referred to me by my friends in those groups. And so I really enjoy it personally, but it's got a professional advantage for sure as well.
Yeah. Would you recommend other attorneys get involved in those types of local activities? Because I know I hear a lot of folks say, well, I'm not going to join the Kiwanis, or I don't feel like joining the Chamber of Commerce because it's just drudgery and I just can't see myself going to those weekly meetings. I guess you can help develop business within that community, but I don't feel like doing it. But people who I see who are successful, like yourselves, are the ones that are taking that challenge up and turning it to their advantage.
Yes. And I think, you know, I think the chamber can be a really good thing. I'm involved in the chamber here, but I do get more referrals from some of the smaller groups that are more specialized. You were talking about, you know, specializing in your practice. The more that you can get around a specialized group, I'm in a group of women and everyone in there has to either own their own business or be in an executive position. And so that's where I really find the best reward as far as personally rewarding and then professionally. You know, not only do they come to me for legal needs, but they'll buy wine as well, which is awesome. But so I think it's, for me, it's vital. It's a part of my career as well as my personal life.
So this might be a little touchy to some degree. Maybe I'm completely wrong, but I think there's a mistaken belief sometimes that women in the South, and particularly places like Texas, are find it more difficult to do some of the things in business that they otherwise shouldn't find to be difficult. Have you experienced bias towards women in your entrepreneurial and legal practices?
Well, unfortunately, I can say yes. And it's not rampant. It's not something that I experience every day. But you know, I'm in a Facebook group where some women attorneys talk about, and I want this to come across the right way because I think everyone in the legal community is vitally important, but there's kind of a running joke about how many times you walk in a room and you're mistaken for the court reporter.
Right.
And it's obviously, we value our court reporters. That's not my suggestion. My suggestion is that incoming bias and belief that a woman walks in and they're in a support role rather than being in the lead role.
Right.
And so I've seen that happen. I've had, you know, whenever I was at my big firm, as I call it, my big little city firm, as a new associate, I had to be one of the people that took incoming cold calls. And so I remember very distinctly, this is one of those memories that I won't forget. Sure. A man called in and it got transferred to me. It was my turn to take the call. And so I said, "This is Elizabeth. How can I help you?" And he said, "Well, I was really hoping to speak to an attorney about an issue I had." And I said, "Okay, go ahead." And he said, "Well, I'd prefer to speak to an attorney, please, ma'am." And I said, "Sir, I am an attorney. Would you like to speak with me or would you like to call someone else?" Yeah. And, you know, he obviously clicked, but it did not even occur to him that I could be the attorney that he was speaking to. And so it's just, you know, little things like that. I say little, but it does have a big impact. I do see it still happening. Where I'm at in Texas, it is still, especially in my field, business litigation, it's still predominantly occupied by males. And so a little more so than in some fields such as family law or some of the other areas. And so I probably see it a bit more. But, you know, for the most part, the majority of people do a good job of being aware of what your own inherent biases or beliefs might be and trying to guard against those. But, you know, it happens and I have seen it and it's unfortunate. But, you know, it's something that we continue to try to educate all of those around us.
Yeah, I know you speak on this on the topic a lot, and I was wondering that it's not hard for me to imagine that it being even more difficult than it is for women in other places around the country, like for instance, my own area, where it's difficult enough at times. I have to believe that out in Lubbock, Texas, that the disadvantage or the perceived issues might be even sharper in contrast than they would be in other places. And so I think folks like yourself that speak up regarding that social aspect of practicing the law are ones that we should pay attention to and follow.
Yeah, I agree. And I haven't lived anywhere else as an attorney, so I don't firsthand know the difference. But what I hear is that the bigger cities, it's not as much of an issue. And so sometimes I think we're a little bit behind the times in kind of the more rural areas, although Lubbock is not rural. It's about 250,000 people, but it's still kind of on the smaller side compared to the big cities. And it's surrounded by a lot of agriculture. And so I do hear that it's a bit more pronounced, I would say, yeah, in these kinds of areas.
On the other hand, you have cleaner air, cleaner water, wider open spaces, and on some days, less traffic.
That's true. There are some pros and cons for sure.
Elizabeth, it's been a delight having you on the show today. Tell our audience how they can reach out to you to follow up on anything they would like to ask you that you haven't covered today.
Well, sure. You can find me, Law Office of Elizabeth G. Hill. My website is lawofficeofegh.com. And I am on Twitter, and you can reach out to me. You can even email me at elizabeth@eghlawoffice.com.
So if we're coming down to watch those Red Raiders play football, we know where to pick up our wine and get some legal advice.
Absolutely, yes. So, and you know, this year you may want to come down and see the Red Raiders play basketball. So
we'll wait till later on in the year.
No, I support all my Red Raiders. I am a Red Raider, as our slogan goes. But yeah, we have a really good basketball team this year. So,
all right. Well, thanks again for being a guest on The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you so much, Neil. I enjoyed being here.
Well, that will do it for today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I'd like to thank our sponsors for making this show possible, the good folks at Call Ruby Receptionists, Jurisdiction, the providers of the Next Level Law Practice Program, and our newest sponsor, lawcoaching.com. So take a moment to visit our show notes and hop on over to their websites for special discounts and savings and other free stuff that you can get, and just support them because they make this podcast possible day in and day out. Also, if you got a couple minutes, pop on over to our own website, thelawentrepreneur.com. We have a couple little articles there. You can also listen to the podcast itself there if you choose to. And sign up for our newsletter or our mailing list. And we don't do a lot. You know, you're not going to bombard you with emails every week. And I do plan on doing a few more this year, but we'd love to have you join our community. And in that sense, you can also go on to our Facebook page. You can find us just by searching on The Law Entrepreneur. You can find out what we got going on a daily basis, sometimes hourly, on the Facebook page. So I'd love to have you join us there. And if you have the time, last but not least, go on over to iTunes, search on The Law Entrepreneur. And if it's something that you believe in and feel strongly about, we'd love for you to leave an honest 5-star review, as well as comments about what you like and dislike about the show, because it does mean a lot to us that you are our community, our listeners, and I want to thank you for making this all possible. So we'll see you next time on The Law Entrepreneur.